New York Times writer and columnist Dan Barry tells the harrowing yet uplifting story of the exploitation and abuse of a resilient group of men with intellectual disability and the heroic efforts of those who helped them to find justice and reclaim their lives. In the tiny Iowa farm town of Adelissa, dozens of men, all with intellectual disability, and all from Texas, lived in an old schoolhouse. Before dawn each morning, they were bused to a nearby processing plant where they eviscerated turkeys in return for food, lodging, and $65 a month. They lived in near servitude for more than 30 years, enduring increasing neglect, exploitation, and physical and emotional abuse until state social workers, local journalists, and one tenacious labor lawyer helped these men achieve freedom. The story is told in The Boys in the Bunkhouse, and we welcome reporter and columnist for the New York Times, Dan Barry, to the roundtable this morning. Dan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe, very much.
What led you to this particular subject?
I write a column for the New York Times called This Land, and I wander around the country just telling stories. And I saw a brief news item in an Iowa newspaper about this case, and it was only about 100 words, but it was about a lawsuit concerning 32 men with intellectual disability living in a schoolhouse for 35 years, working in a turkey processing plant for 35 years, and being paid $65 a month for 35 years. So I saw all those things, and I said, I need to know more about this.
When you started to investigate, and I guess the first question I have is, what were just some of those questions that you had that you immediately wanted to know more about?
It sounded Dickensian to me, Joe. It sounded like something out of Steinbeck. I couldn't really believe what I was reading. And so I called the attorney who had handled the case for these men, 32 men with intellectual disability, all from Texas. And I called and asked whether I could speak to the men, because I needed to speak to the men if I were to write about this story. I needed them to be a part of their own narrative. And the lawyer said, no one has spoken to the men. And I said, why not? And he said, because no one has asked. And at that moment, I really understood the chasm that exists between the so-called non-disabled world and the world of people with intellectual disability. There's a separation there. And I wanted to, you know, in my own small way, close that and explore what happened to these men and how could it have happened in the United States in real time.
Once you were able to do the interviews and to dive very deeply into the lives of the men, how long did it take for you to get a true picture of what they endured?
That's a good question. I think it took quite a while. These men have intellectual disability, which means that they have an IQ between 35 and 70, and some are more articulate than others. But I visited them time and time again in Iowa, and also some of them were living in Texas, and slowed it down with them and said, all right, tell me what happened. Tell me how you lived. Tell me who did what to whom, because these men were physically abused at times and also emotionally abused. And what I found was that the men always told the same stories. And if Willie Levi or if Gene Berg or any of the other men told you something happened, they might not have the time right. Like they might say, oh, that happened last week when it happened 10 years ago. But beyond that, if they said that Tommy Johnson got kicked and slapped in the head and handcuffed to his bed, it happened. And so spending a lot of time with the men and finding records and talking to others, I was able to, I think, really create what it was like in this bunkhouse where these men lived in Iowa.
Even by the cover of the book and using words like Dickensian and Steinbeck, you certainly go back to a far gone era. We're talking about 2009 here.
Right. And what happened was these men were all part of the state school system in Texas. That means they were in institutions in Texas. And I'm from New York, and you and I have an understanding of, say, Willowbrook and some other places in New York State. These men were in these state institutions when they were children. Okay, their families couldn't take care of them, or it was recommended that the children be put in these institutions. And in some cases, the families never saw these boys ever again. Then they grow up, and now the idea is, let's get them out of the institutions, teach them a trade, and we'll figure out how they can become taxpayers. This is a big thought, that they become taxpaying citizens, that they pay their own way. So they were taught how to work with turkeys, and then a company called Henry's Turkey Service said, why don't we send these guys out, like subcontract them out to turkey processing plants around the country. So some of the men went to Illinois, some went to South Carolina, and the men that I'm writing about all went to a very small town in Iowa called Adelissa. And beginning in 1974, they lived in this old schoolhouse in the town of Adelissa. They got up at 3:30 in the morning, and they went to work at the turkey plant. And at the turkey plant, they had the single worst jobs in the turkey plant. If you've ever been in a meat processing plant, it's a difficult work environment. These guys had the worst jobs in that difficult work environment. They had to unload the live turkeys from these crates that pulled up in trucks, hang them on shackles, and then after the turkeys were stunned and killed, these men had to defeather them and eviscerate them. And they did this day after day for 30, 35 years.
Ultimately, how did the owners of Henry's Turkey Service defend what they did, defend what most of us would look at as abuse and exploitation?
And I spoke to the owners, and they've been roundly criticized and ostracized over this. The two men who created this company, though, have since died. But I talked to one of them before he died, and his defense was, look, no one else cared about these boys, and they called them boys, which is a diminutive. Like, even though these men were in their 50s and 60s and 70s toward the end, they're still called boys. And he said, look, no one else cared about these guys, these boys. They were dropped off at the institutions, and they would have rotted in those institutions, and it would have hurt the taxpayers. We took them out of there. We taught them how to catch turkeys or work with turkeys, and we paid them. We took them in, and we created a fraternity when no one else cared about them. The problem with that is that the men wound up living in squalor in that bunkhouse, that schoolhouse, because it fell into disrepair, great disrepair. It was cockroach-infested and leaking ceilings. It was a horrible place. And also, they were being financially exploited. They were only being paid $65 a month for full work weeks. And lastly, they were denied basic rights. They weren't allowed to say, "Hey, you know, I don't want to work here. I'd rather work somewhere else. Hey, I'd like to live somewhere else. I'd like to have a girlfriend." None of those things were allowed to these men. And so the argument of the owners goes only so far.
And it is important, and I mean, you just touched on this, but it is important to realize that the conditions got worse as the oversight started to falter, correct?
That's right. So in the beginning, the men are brought there in 1974, and the company has rented out an old schoolhouse, and they've tricked it out into kind of like almost a college dormitory where they have bunk beds and they have a pool table and some exercise equipment. So you could argue that it wasn't a bad place in the beginning, and maybe marginally better than being in an institution. But as the years went by, the people who were supervising these men had no training whatsoever to work with people with intellectual disability. They had no idea. Secondly, the infrastructure began to collapse, and they didn't repair the building as it collapsed. So when there was a leak in the ceiling, they didn't fix it. Rather, they just put a bucket in the middle of a man's bedroom or in the middle of the dining room, and the cockroaches really ran rampant. And the open bathroom stalls were fetid and disgusting. And this happened over the years. It declined, but it was a steady bad situation for many years.
You do write in the book, and I think it's an interesting one, of the question that we so often ask ourselves when we read about stories of abuse, and certainly in this case, of why didn't the men complain? And as you point out, it's the same question that comes up when we talk about domestic violence and workplace harassment and bullying. So when you look and you talk to these men, do you get a sense of why they didn't complain?
I struggled with that question. And the people who lived in the small town where the schoolhouse was located, it's really only about 200 people or so. And some of them really took care of these men as best as they could in town. They would give them Christmas gifts and celebrate their birthdays and, you know, befriended them, would dance with them at the local tavern on a Friday night, you know, things like that. And they said, but, you know, geez, we never realized how bad it was inside that bunkhouse. The men never complained. I thought, first, the men don't want to complain because they don't want to be seen as something less. They imagine themselves as men, and they are men, and they don't want to be seen as boys, even though they're being called boys. They want to be a guy who can dance with a woman at the tavern. But then I spoke with an expert in intellectual disability, and she said, no, you don't get it. The reason the men never complained was because they had never known anything better. She said, think about it. When their children, their families effectively abandon them, they live for a long time in an institution, and no one would want to live in an institution. It was particularly in the 60s and 70s, it was a horrible situation. And so this life that they have, however circumscribed it is and however devoid of freedom that it was better than being in the institution. So if you're Willie Levi or if you're Gene Berg or Raymond Vaughn, you think, this is better than what it had been, so you're not going to complain.
When you read the book, it's almost impossible to realize the anonymity of these men and what they were going through and not think that there are other men and women going through very similar things.
Right. You know, I think the tendency is to think of this as a one-off, and maybe we feel better about ourselves if we think, oh, that was an aberration over there in Annalisa, Iowa. But after I wrote a story about this for the New York Times in early 2014, some social workers who had come to the rescue of these men, and there were a lot of heroes in the story, so there's a lot of redemptive qualities to the story ultimately, these social workers said, Dan, there are more going on. There's more like this. We found some records that indicating it might be happening in South Carolina as well. And I resisted going to South Carolina. They were saying, you have to go down there. You have to go down there. And I, quite frankly, I didn't want to, but they prevailed, quite frankly, and got the better of my Irish Catholic guilt. And so I went down to Newberry, South Carolina, and sure enough, here is a huge turkey processing plant to the left, and to the right is a squalid bunkhouse, a series of mobile homes all connected together. And I knock on the door. And answering the door is a man who is the brother of one of the men living in the bunkhouse in Annalisa. You know, so there are two brothers with intellectual disability. One is in Iowa, and the other one is sent to South Carolina. So the company even splits up brothers. So I introduce myself. His hands are disfigured or contorted from the repetitive work he's been doing for many years. And his job is to work at the plant across the street, picking up the DOAs. He's in charge of picking up the dead turkeys that fall off the trucks. And he's being paid a paltry amount. And he's living in a very small corner of a large dormitory. He has about maybe, you know, 15 square feet of living space. And he's in his mid-60s. So this is his world. So that tells me that it wasn't a one-off, that this happens in the workplace and in society around the country, that people with intellectual disability are ignored and abused in subtle ways.
You spoke a moment ago about the redemptive qualities, the stories of redemption in this book. Give us some examples of that.
Well, there were times where you know, first, as I said, the people in the town did kind of take care of the men as best they could, you know,
right.
Buying them gifts and or making them gifts and cakes and really making them feel a part of the community, accepting them in the local church and joining them in singing in the choir and all that kind of stuff. But the redemptive qualities I was talking about was less about the town and more about those who came to the men's rescue. In early 2009, a sister of one of the men called up the company and said, hey, my brother's been working for you for 35 years. How much does he have in the bank? And the answer was $86. And she hit the roof. And she called a bunch of state agencies in Iowa, agencies that in the past had ignored other tips and complaints about this operation. And she also called a reporter who specialized in investigations at the Des Moines Register. And together they tipped over the garbage can. And one afternoon, this bunkhouse that had been ignored for so many years was suddenly like a crime scene. There were dozens of investigators, and they worked together to get the guys out of there. And so the heroes, to my mind, the redemptive qualities are the social workers who rose to the occasion and took care of the men, because the men are removed from an environment they've known for many years, and they're, some of them are kind of shaken by this. And these social workers really, really took care of them and helped them make the transition to a better life. And also there was a lawyer for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission named Robert Canino, who took it upon himself to make this kind of a crusade, to fight for the rights of these men and suing the company that had exploited them. And then after he won that lawsuit, making sure that the men were living in good conditions and enjoying the rights that had been denied to them for so many years. So now if you go to a town where several of them live in Iowa, you're liable to bump into Willie Levi at the local supermarket, or you might bump into Gene Berg down at the tavern. So they're living the lives that have been denied to them. So that's the redemptive quality. They suffered for a long time, but now many of them are doing quite well.
The name of the book, The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. It is published by Harper. Dan Barry, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland, by Dan Barry. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.